It is an honor and a privilege to have my next guest on. I've had the pleasure of meeting him in the past, one, my buddy Chris Cuomo. He served four terms as a Republican governor of the great state of New Hampshire. He is now the CEO and president of Airlines for America, a Washington, D.C.-based trade and lobbying group that works to keep aviation the safest mode of transportation. Please welcome, for the first time, Straight Shooter, former governor Chris Sununu is on the line with us right now. What's up, sir? How are you, sir? How does it feel to be called former governor, sir? How do you like that? You seem to be pretty happy for somebody that's not in office anymore. How do you feel?
I love being governor. Honor of a lifetime. Toughest, most fulfilling job I ever had, and I love being a former governor as well. Life is pretty good. Now, I have to be down here in D.C., and I'm a pretty big cynic of this town, as most Americans should be. But other than that, it's good. It's just not being able to go on a vacation or take a long weekend without panicking that something terrible was going to happen or whatever it might be.
Right. So
a little bit of a break is pretty good. And no one loves it more than my family, by the way. I'm making a little more money and they don't have to be in the public eye.
I got you. Listen, Chris, let me ask you this question. May I call you Chris or would you like me to call you governor? Whatever you want. All right. Let me ask you this. You were on Capitol Hill today. You know, why were you on Capitol Hill and what are the kind of things that you were discussing with our elected officials?
Yeah, well, look, at the heart of it, I was on Capitol Hill because shutdowns, and we've had two of them now in just the past 9 months, are awful. And they're awful for America. And what we were talking about on Capitol Hill was TSA in particular. Remember this last shutdown? TSA workers not getting paid for almost 2 months. I mean, when you're making an average of $40,000-$50,000 and you don't get paid for 2 months, I mean, do you know what kind of stress that puts on these poor individuals? So just trying to get Capitol Hill to understand that, A, they got to invest in new technologies and safety and security, and I think they're going to do that. But B, don't stop paying your own workers. Don't, you know, over a political fight, forget to have political fights, but you don't hold the public hostage in terms of how they want to travel, and those tens of thousands of what we call our TSO workers, those men and women in blue that get us through the airplane safety, the airline safely, you know, that those are the last people you want stressed out and not coming to work
because
they can't make a paycheck, right? It's like the dumbest thing Congress could do. So we're there pleading with them and getting them to understand that there were massive repercussions, cost the economy billions, cost thousands of people, you know, quit those really important jobs. And God bless them. Most of them kept coming. But yeah, just really getting Congress to realize that if you want to have a political fight, that's fine. But you can't do it at the expense of everybody else. Because at the end of the day, there's just no winners, you know?
What level of disgust should the American public feel in this day and age, specifically at this moment, when we just witnessed a second shutdown where they couldn't come up with $2 billion to pay TSA workers over a month? But you got $2 billion a day for a war with Iran.
Yeah.
How should we feel? How should we feel about that?
You ever see the movie Spinal Tap, the famous line from Spinal Tap? This one goes to 11. And that's the level, right? It's at an 11. And the worst part about it, we can talk about these instances of the shutdown versus the war. And it's clearly not about money because these guys in Washington just want to spend money they don't have. I mean, it's never quite about money. It's about another political fight. But the real frustration, and you know, our government is awesome in that it was designed really, really well. I'm from New England. I'm a New England guy. So we say, you know, the founding fathers were wicked smart, right? They really designed this thing well. But what it means is Congress is really important and they have to be effective. They have to do their job. They have to get stuff done. They have to keep things moving, even when they disagree. And over the last few years, because of this the politicalization of everything, right? The polarization that they have, the populism, it forces them to do less and less and become more and more insignificant. And that's unhealthy for the government. From a pure civic standpoint, that's not what you want to see, right? You want the systems to be working. They can disagree. You give a little, you get a lot, can't get what you want every time. Maybe you got to fight harder next year. That's all okay. But these guys, if they don't get exactly what they want, they're going to shut it down and take their ball and go home. And you know, in some ways, both sides are to blame. I mean, I try to stay fairly nonpartisan on it. They're all to blame. So, you know, the best thing we can do and my job is to keep going to them from the private sector, but someone who's worked in the public sector and say, guys, you're losing. You're losing America, right? You're losing the confidence of the people that you're supposed to be, you know, working for. And so it's frustrating. But and to your point, yeah, I think we're at about an 11 at this point.
You know, I'm wondering, is there a point, knowing politics the way that you do, being aware of what transpires in Washington the way that most people don't, even though you were the governor of New Hampshire, you still know what the hell you're talking about and you kind of know the players. I'm wondering if there's a time where you could, that you could specifically pinpoint for us where this polarization that you alluded to really took on a life of its own and descended to the depths that it has descended to. Is there one point, a point in time where you're able to say, that's when it happened? That's when it took to the point of no return?
So I think there's 2 points. I would say 2008, two things happened. And I'm not blaming one side or the other, but that's when social media really starts becoming a tool. And President Obama, in his first election, his team really knew how to use it. And, you know, to get himself elected, and that was fine. Nothing wrong with that. No complaints there. But it became this thing where a guy in his basement could shout to the world, having no background information or education on anything, and almost build a voice for himself. And all of a sudden, what somebody might have said online, well, maybe that's something that were based in fact, even though there was nothing behind it. And then the second inflection point comes around 2015 in the first Trump campaign, in the Trump election, where not just are they using social media, but the extremes really start defining, not defining the parties, because I think the majority of Republicans are still, you know, what kind of, I'll call them in the middle, moderate Republicans, the majority of Democrats are kind of in the middle. But the microphones have been handed to the extremes because the bigger media, if you will, the CNNs and the Foxes and all that, that's when they start picking their sides. And the whole idea of kind of this, you know, non-biased independent journalism really starts kind of disappearing because everyone realizes there's a strong buck to be made with populism. So it goes from polarization to populism, what we've been dealing with at least over the past 8 years here or so. And I'd like to think that we're not stuck here. We'll keep evolving. We're Gen X, right? So I always say we were brilliant in that we were smart enough to invent social media, but we did not have the maturity to understand how to use it. And so it's a little bit counting on that next generation coming up through it that understands the pros and the cons, the pushes and the pulls, the truth and the lies. And now they're dealing with AI. Now we're going to throw AI into that mix. That's an even harder piece of the puzzle to see where that's going to take us in terms of what's real and what isn't. But yeah, so there's a couple inflection points. And again, we're all to blame. I try not to do the whole your side versus my side thing. You know, I'm a strong Republican, but there are a lot of Republicans that not just I might disagree with on principle, but more often I disagree with some of them on messaging and method. And that means a lot to the American public in terms of how we communicate.
Former governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, currently serving as CEO and president of Airlines for America, right here with Straight Shooter with Stephen A. on SiriusXM POTUS Radio. You spent years warning Republicans not to become a personality-driven party. Yet here we are with Donald Trump, who is now stronger politically than ever. Looking back, were you wrong about where Republican voters wanted the party to go?
No, I'll say this. I don't think Republicans voters were wrong. We got what we wanted, right? We got what we voted for. And what we were voting for, what America voted for, wasn't a Republican or a Democrat per se. They wanted a disruptor, right? You know, they wanted someone that was really going to challenge the system, disrupt the system, because as we started this conversation, so many folks have lost faith in Washington, D.C. as a whole. So I don't like the term blow it up and start again and all that kind of stuff. But let's get someone in there that challenges the system, doesn't mind breaking a few eggs, and worst case scenario is at least going to move, is at least going to do something. And that's where I do give the President Trump a lot of credit. This guy's moving. He's moving faster and on more initiatives than any other president in history. I think he learned from the first time. Things didn't quite happen the way he wanted. He got frustrated with Congress. Now, I believe you have to have Congress as part of that mix. You need a checks and balances on the system. And you know, he pushes the system to its nth limit, so to say, until, you know, the court or the Supreme Court has to come back and tell him to pull back. But yeah, his philosophy is, I got 4 years. Every day that goes by is another day when I'm not getting something done. And so he's trying to put people in there that just get it done, engage with the private sector, let free markets work, really, you know, make sure that it's not a bureaucracy driven system, but, you know, a market in a people driven system. I love that concept. I'm a free market guy. I love that. Sometimes we don't like the method and the message. I get all that. There can be a lot of frustrations there, both internally and externally. But at the end of the day, this is what America asked for. And so, you know, this is what you get. But, you know, people always say, oh, democracy, if you elect Kamala Harris, democracy, you know, we'll be a bunch of socialists. And if you elect Donald Trump, democracy will be eroded. And I tell people, stop, stop. Democracy is so healthy because everybody votes, right? Everyone's involved in the process now. We have the highest voter turnout we've ever had. And that's a very, very, very strong and very, very good thing. And the pendulum swings. Unlike other parts of the world, most other parts of the world, where one party or one group controls everything for sometimes decades at a time. I mean, remember, we had Bush 41, and then we had Clinton, and then we had Bush 43, and it went back to Obama, and then it went to Trump, and then it went to Biden. So our pendulum swings, and that's a very, very healthy thing. It can be incredibly frustrating for half the country when it doesn't swing our way, but know that it will swing back because our democracy is very, very healthy.
But that's what you say, and I get that. But the pushback would be, look at the whole redistricting and gerrymandering thing that's been going on. Look at what Trump did in Louisiana with Cassidy, what he did in Indiana, you know, what he's done in various places. And you see the Republicans in an absolute panic because if you cross him or he deems you as somebody that doesn't vibe with him totally, you are clearly going to pay a price because of the grip he has on the GOP. People look at that and they say, we've got elected politicians, 435 representatives, 100 senators, a vast majority of them, whether you're on one side of the aisle or the other, you certainly want the impression that they're their own individuals as opposed to being at the mercy of somebody who, dare we say, could come across as very ruthless and vindictive and stuff like that. How is that a healthy democracy? To that, you say what?
So a couple of things. The gerrymandering, you're 120% spot on. Coincidentally, I don't know if it's a pat myself on the back or what, but in 2020, when all the governors got their redistricting bills passed, you know, because you do the census every 10 years, I was the only governor in the country that just refused to sign what my own Republican legislature gave to me because it was gerrymandered. It made one of my districts in New Hampshire solidly Democrat, one of them solidly Republican. And I said, no, we're a purple state. Right. You know, got to make sure that everyone has a shot in any district to win. So I ended up never signing any of the bills that they handed me because you are right. Redistricting is the genie that can never be put back into the bottle. It's done at the state level. The federal government can't really control it. What started as, you know, Texas and California threatening to redistrict themselves has turned into this virus of gerrymandering across the country, which is awful. And that, you're right. I think there are three things that threaten the whole process. Redistricting, too much money in the system. We need severe campaign finance reform because there's so many billions of dollars that go into the system that aren't aligned with the interests even of the candidate or the folks voting. And term limits. I'm now a huge believer in term limits because especially in Washington, D.C., people just far overstay their welcome. And once you get entrenched here in Washington, because of your ability to raise money, it gets so hard to folks to move out. Now, at the end of the day, people still have a vote. They absolutely still have a vote, no matter how gerrymandering never actually works out, by the way, no matter how you try to rig the system. Right now, we're still going to, it'll be a little bit Democrat here and a little bit Republican there. Democrats could take the Senate this time. So I still believe the pendulum is going to keep swinging back and forth, but it does mean that the number of independent districts shrinks. And to your point, you're spot on. That aspect is very unhealthy. But people,
and am I right?
That's the good news. We want people to keep coming out and voting.
And am I right in saying that both parties are guilty of it? I had one caller call up a few minutes ago talking about how the Democrats tried to get rid of it. I said, that's not true.
No.
I said, you know, they've been involved in it every bit as much as the Republicans have. They're both guilty of this. Was I right in saying that?
Yeah. The Democrats, I mean, look what the Democrats tried to do in Virginia and in California. Look what the Republicans have tried to do in Texas and now in a bunch of the other southern states. So, no, it is, you know, it's just like, remember 4 or 5 years ago? I mean, you're probably not paying attention to politics as much, but, you know, one state said, oh, we got to get rid of the filibuster. Oh, no, we're not going to get rid of the filibuster. And then power completely switches in the Senate and everyone who wants to get rid of filibuster doesn't want to get rid of it anymore and vice versa.
Right.
So everyone has their, I'll call it situational ethics, right? Whatever
there you go.
Deems,
great words.
Where they're going to be. And that should be incredibly frustrating. And that's exactly at the heart. The American people aren't dumb. People are not dumb. They're watching what's happening, and they're very frustrated with this town. I'm still optimistic. I'm still hopeful things can change. I think what you're going to see, if I may, is if Washington keeps doing going down this path of being ineffectual, the states are going to pick up the slack. And that's where there is more control with their governors and their state legislatures, their local. And I'm a huge believer in local control. I'd much rather have people have more power and control at a local level than here in Washington. Mm-hmm. And to Washington's demise, if you will, or erosion, will be the opportunity for states and cities to step up and do their own thing. And that is where you kind of can avoid the gerrymandering thing and the redistricting thing. So I think states are gonna it's not gonna be easy, but hopefully they'll have a little more power, a little more control, and that allows the citizens themselves to have a little more say.
I want to get to you, former Governor Chris Sununu, right here with Stephen A. Straight Shooter. I want to get to you in this regard. Did I read this right? The United States is nearly 3,000 air traffic controllers short at a time of record air travel and increased reliance on air cargo, and air traffic controllers still use outdated equipment like floppy disks, copper wiring, and old phones to keep our skies safe. Is that true, sir?
Basically true. So the number isn't quite 3,000. It's more like 1,500. We've put in some new technologies and things so that the demand isn't quite as high as it was maybe a year or two ago. But the system itself, the air traffic control system itself, is held together by string and duct tape. Now, it is safe. Make no question, it is safe. But what we do here in America, because it's such a big and robust system, we slow all of our airplanes down. We block way more time between flights to ensure that safety, given we're dealing with such an antiquated system. Now, here's the good news. And here's an area where there's no question you have to give President Trump credit. They put $12 billion forward. They're changing the radars, the radios. They're looking at new software systems. They're going to make this probably in just the next couple of years one of the most high-tech, advanced, safest systems in the world, because they're finally, after 40 years of ignoring it, I mean, it's literally, you know, the old computer program COBOL. There's literally floppy disks with COBOL on it that are still going into 1993-style computers that keep part of our air traffic control system running. That is no exaggeration. It's crazy. Now, that's all finally being changed. It'll all be changed over in just the next couple of years. It's already happening as we speak. Been very successful. It's actually a public works project that is, believe it or not, is, you know, on budget and on time. And it's going really well. Secretary Duffy and DOT and Brian Bedford at the FAA manage that. And believe it or not, this piece of garbage system is finally getting the love and care that it needs with some really
cool issues. How soon will we be able to say, you know, it's great without using words duct tape and thread and all of that stuff? I mean, that's scary because I fly 30,000, 35,000, 40,000 feet in the air all the time. That's some scary stuff to hear, sir. I mean, how long before we don't have to worry about hearing it's kept together by duct tape and stuff like that, figuratively speaking?
Believe it or not, I don't think you have to worry today, but it'll be really solid. In about 18 months, some of the things they're putting in place now in a few areas will really be nationwide. And I think you'll have a super cool system. And by the way, it reduces delays. It reduces, all the different hassles and stumbling points along the way. It makes the whole system faster and more efficient. I've seen it. I've been in the back rooms and seen this technology, what they're bringing to bear. And it's really cool stuff. So we're on the cusp. We're on the cusp. But you should stop flying. But keep buying your tickets.
Okay. You're also working to save our frequent flyer points. Last year, 15 million Americans used points from airline credit cards to book flights. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill threatens to take away the points and rewards consumers accrue for everyday items like gas and groceries. Talk about what you're doing to protect that issue.
These point programs, so do you have one? Do you have a credit card, Stephen A?
Yes, I do.
You fly.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
So most Americans have them. They love their points. And as you know, it allows somebody to go buy their groceries here, but be able to get a free ticket to visit grandma and have their family travel there. So it's awesome for kind of middle America, low-income Americans who otherwise might not be able to afford to travel. And so there are bills. What those are funded is that little extra couple percent you pay when you use your credit card. That funds the whole program. That basically reimburses the airlines for your free ticket. So when they want to cut that fee, which it sounds great. Hey, let's cut the fees on credit cards. That sounds awesome, right? The points programs will go away. And that is billions and billions and billions of dollars of free stuff that we give America. And so we're trying to remind people, it sounds good to get rid of the points programs, but that's how to get rid of the credit card fees. But that's how these point programs are funded and work. It would have awful repercussions. I don't know if you remember, maybe like 5, 10 years ago, your debit card, you could get loyalty points. You could get hotel points and airline miles on your debit card. Can't do it anymore. Why? Because Washington thought they were smarter than everyone else and basically passed laws that prohibited the mechanism at which that stuff was funded. And a lot of middle Americans just lost their programs. And that sucked. So these programs are great. Everyone uses them. They're incredibly robust. And we just try to, you know, this is a good example of, you know, sometimes something sounds really good in government, but when you look under the hood, you go, wait a minute here. This is going to have some real negative repercussions. So, you know, it sounds kind of wonky, but it is an important program for so many millions of folks. We just like to remind folks that, you know, use your credit cards, use your points, get your free stuff. We love giving it away, but you don't let the government take it away from you. Don't let the government do dumb things.
Before I let you get on out of here, I got a couple of questions, Mr. Chris Sununu. Number one, you governed a true swing state. If you were advising Republicans right now, what's the biggest thing the national GOP is doing that could quietly cost them suburban and independent voters? I ask you that question because obviously the midterms are approaching.
They don't keep it local. Too many politicians and political voices just look to Washington and the national voice. And I'm not just saying it's a Trump voice, but the national issues. When you talk about your local issues, what's happening in your schools, what's happening in your district, what's happening in your community, now you start connecting with people. And I see, especially Republicans, they just, because we have the White House and we have control of Congress right now, local folks or even congressmen are talking about national issues when you want to connect with somebody to show that you're normal. The people overthink it. They do things for a headline as opposed to what really impacts their voters. And when you, and like I said, voters are smarter than a lot of people give them credit for. Just be normal, man. Politics is not hard, by the way. It ain't rocket science. You know, I know a lot of people think that, you know, those politicians are evilly scheming behind the closed doors. Let me tell you something. We're not that smart. Don't give us that much credit. You know, if you just keep it simple as a politician and connect someone one-on-one and just be normal, I got to be honest, this conversation is a good example. I don't feel normal right now. We're coming off. I have to interject it. I know you don't want me to. The fact that they had a 22-point comeback in the fourth quarter last night. My son tells me you're on with Stephen A. Smith and you're not talking about the Knicks. I said, I don't know what to do. I'm not allowed to do that. He said, well, at least profile Wimby's performance. I said, I don't think I'm allowed.
You can bring it up. You can bring up Wimby and you can bring up the Knicks. I think the way it's looking, if Oklahoma City doesn't win tonight, it's going to be San Antonio and the Knicks in the NBA Finals. I thought that was an epic performance by Wimby the other night in game one. It was unbelievable. And Oklahoma City's going to have to really step up their game to win this series. And I thought that Jalen Brunson was absolutely fantastic. So fantastic, I actually felt sorry for James Harden because he was abused so badly by Jalen Brunson. I thought he should have been arrested for assault. That's how bad Jalen Brunson abused him.
Yeah, and I'm not the biggest Harden fan, but again, you thought, okay, he's going to break the little Harden curse here. Maybe he's going to come through. He's going to actually pull his team through. He's not going to be this anchor.
Oh, you know your basketball. Okay.
Yeah. No. Okay. And again, you know, I know the history, and we all know the history of what's happened there. And so I actually started pulling for James, and I did. But, I mean, I'm a Boston and New England guy, and we just completely crapped the bed, obviously, in the first round here. But after what happened in the Knicks, I'm not a Knicks fan. I'm not a New York fan in any way. So I was actually rooting a bit for Cleveland, and they weren't able to pull it through. But I am also, I got to be honest, Wemby's incredible. But that one game, let's not forget what Oklahoma City is. They are phenomenal.
That's right.
And if there's anything, we all saw that look on Wemby's face when they were announcing the SGA. Gets
the MVP. That's what I'm saying. You knew it. You knew it was coming.
That was giving the.
He's coming to take everything.
Antonio.
He's coming to take everything. Last question before I get out of here. I asked you a question about the Republicans. Yeah. Now I got to go to you about the Democrats. And I'll ask you this. Polling shows Democrats are struggling. It's not just Trump struggling badly in the polls. Democrats are struggling badly with working class voters and young men. Is this just a messaging problem? Or do you think Democrats genuinely not understand a huge chunk of the country anymore? Where do you lie in that thinking?
Problem. The Democrats have completely don't understand what makes working class Americans tick. They took advantage of them for years. They can try to re-message that, but it's not there. The substance has to be there, and it's not. And so that's why Republicans, not really working very hard for it, just talking about very middle America issues, started connecting with folks. And so, look, do I think the Democrats are in trouble and all that? No, not necessarily, because everything's about get out the vote. It's not about who agrees with you. It's about who actually shows up at the polls for you. And so the Democrats may still be very successful this year, even though they're not doing well with middle America, because a lot of middle America will be kind of apathetic and they won't show up for the Republicans. So that's where, you know, it's they do much better on the organization, the getting out the vote, literally getting people to the polls and all that sort of thing. We take it as Republicans, you know, we think being the smartest people in the room is enough. It's not.
Right.
You got to do the work to earn the vote. So, you know, but like I said, that pendulum's going to swing back and forth for a variety of different reasons for a few years. It's a healthy system. And I just encourage everyone, to your point, get out and vote. I don't care who you vote for, but be part of the process. Right. Don't sit on the internet and just cry about it. Actually go out and do something about it.
And you don't believe that when it comes to the voting, that Black Americans are going to be compromised because of all of this redistricting that has gone on and the way that folks, the NAACP and others, are complaining that Black folks are going to be compromised at the booth. You don't believe that to be the case?
No, not at all. Not at all. Because, look, there's going to be Black Republicans that are elected. There's going to still be Black Democrats that are elected. So, no, I don't buy that. I don't buy that. I think that. Okay. You know, don't move my cheese, right? Don't mess with my thing. My thing is really good right now. Why are you messing with it? And so obviously folks are going to complain, but at the end of the day, and I don't want to get into whether the court's decision was right or wrong, but again, as long as people get out and vote, people connect on local levels, I'm a firm believer anybody can win. I really believe that.
Gotcha. Chris Sununu, former governor for New Hampshire, current CEO and president of Airlines for America, right here on Straight Shooter with Stephen A. I really enjoyed talking to you. You know, you're welcome back anytime. It's good to see you again. And you do know your basketball. I like that. I like that. Thanks a lot, sir.
We'll catch up in the finals.
All right, buddy. You take care. The one and only Chris Sununu right here on Straight Shooter with yours truly, Stephen A. 866-967-6887. That's 866-96-POTUS. You're listening live to Straight Shooter with yours truly. Back to your phone calls. A few lines are open in a minute.